Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Hope Rugo, and to begin, I asked her about an interesting data set presented at the recent ASCO meeting. Initial results of the so-called Phyrexa trial, a phase 3 study, looking at the combination of trastuzumab and capecitabine with or without pertuzumab in metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer.
That is a complicated trial, and I think that we're all still pondering the information, which is intriguing, but perplexing at the same time. So in that trial, they showed that you could have an improvement in overall survival, but not a significant improvement in progression-free survival, which was their primary endpoint. We don't see that much. And it was pointed out at the time of the presentation that we have seen that sort of result in immunotherapy trials in other cancers, but we haven't seen it in breast cancer. So I think as a unique trial, it's an interesting one. Cleopatra also showed a bigger impact relatively on survival than on progression-free survival, but they did show a big difference in progression-free survival. So it may be that as you get farther along in the course of therapy, that adding another antibody, in this case pertuzumab to trastuzumab, doesn't help as much in terms of disease control because you've developed alternate mechanisms of resistance. Explaining that survival difference is hard because survival is a hard endpoint. And I think we need to understand in that patient population whether there were any differences in the treatment options available to the patients on either arm before we can universally incorporate pertuzumab into later line therapy. Now, I will say there's one take-home message, which is that in patients who haven't had pertuzumab with chemo, it's reasonable to try and give it in the second-line setting if they've gotten an alternate therapy without pertuzumab. But I think other than that, we really need to wait for more information from the Phyrexa trial. Quite an interesting and perplexing set of results.
Would you combine trastuzumab and pertuzumab with in the patient in whom you don't want to use a taxane?
Well, in general, we've used paclitaxel or docetaxel. It's a little easier to use docetaxel because of the scheduling, but definitely have given both. We have occasionally given the combination antibodies with hormone therapy in patients who've had long history of HER2-positive disease, very indolent. But in terms of capecitabine, I haven't used that combination yet. I think that with this data, we know we can give it. It's reasonably safe. You have to watch out for diarrhea, which is an issue with pertuzumab being added anyway. So it's really important to educate patients. But I think it does support the fact that you could use capecitabine in this setting if a patient had already received a taxane or had an absolute contraindication to any taxane. For example, severe neuropathy, unable to walk, something like that. I can't think of another reason because you could always use nab-paclitaxel if it's allergy.
So what about the use of capecitabine in patients with HER2-positive disease? Where generally do you tend to utilize it and with what?
I used to use it earlier, actually, but because now we have pertuzumab and generally insurers want to improve it in the first line setting with a taxane. And if you use it in another way, you can't give it with a taxane. So in order to sort of play that game and following the Cleopatra data with this huge survival benefit, we've given it first line with a taxane. Then there is data suggesting that trastuzumab amtansine or T-DM1 also results in a survival benefit after trastuzumab and a taxane. Now, we don't have the pertuzumab data, but there are some case series that will be, I think, published in the not-too-distant future with a little bit of retrospective data. So we tend to use trastuzumab amtansine as a second line. In the third line setting, I use capecitabine. And I give capecitabine usually in combination with both trastuzumab and lapatinib at the current time, because lapatinib and capecitabine may overcome some type of resistance that is not overcome by trastuzumab amtansine, which uses a microtubule inhibitor and trastuzumab, and the pertuzumab-trastuzumab combination. So you've given a lot of the same sort of therapy in those first two lines. So giving something different, I think, is quite reasonable. And I do that also for patients for whom brain is their dominant location. For example, I had a patient with HER2-positive, ER-positive disease who recurred in brain only at about 12 months after stopping her adjuvant trastuzumab. And that patient I have just on trastuzumab and lapatinib because her brain lesion was resected and radiated. So at that point, I'm just going to put her on targeted therapy.
That's interesting. Have you seen any responses to trastuzumab lapatinib in the brain?
I have occasionally seen responses in certainly stable disease. I also have a patient who had a resected brain lesion who went on a study we had with lapatinib and bevacizumab and has been NED for now 5 years.
Lapatinib and bevacizumab, that's interesting. There's been discussion about finding agents or have been agents in development specifically targeting brain mets in HER2-positive disease. Anything exciting out there?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we're seeing some early data. There was data with trastuzumab amtansine, TDM1. So clearly in some patients, the drug crosses the blood-brain barrier. But one of the main issues, the reasons why patients failed in our initial phase 2 trial was progression in brain. So nothing is perfect by any means. But I think we have the lapatinib data, as I mentioned. Neratinib also crosses the blood-brain barrier, and there's been some data on that potent HER2 and EGFR inhibitor. Obviously, toxicity has been an issue, but I think that there is now some data suggesting that with the right prophylaxis, that you might be able to control the diarrhea reasonably well. And there's ongoing investigations looking at alternative mechanisms of controlling the diarrhea. And of course, if the drug gets approved based on the Extenet data, then we'll have it available to treat patients with brain mets. There also are some other small molecule inhibitors that block the HER family, such as ONT-380. That is also a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And there is data combined with capecitabine that this drug may be very potent and effective in treating brain metastases. Now, what you see in an initial small phase 2 trial may not be what we see in larger studies, but I think that that's quite an interesting drug and will be followed along to see if we can target patients who have brain metastases with that agent. And there are some other small molecules also being studied.
So I want to also ask you about a really interesting presentation you did at ASCO, the so-called Heritage trial that looked at MYL14010, a biosimilar to trastuzumab. What did you look at there, and what's your conclusion of what it showed?
So this agent is a proposed trastuzumab biosimilar, and the regulatory agencies, the FDA and the EMA, have developed regulatory guidelines for getting approval of biosimilars. So the first question is what a biosimilar is, and we think about the generics we see all the time, letrozole, aspirin, for example, and these are generally simple chemicals that are easy to reproduce, and you can show that they're structurally identical and believe for that reason that they will also be identical in clinical practice. The biosimilars really represent a group of complex chemicals, usually targeted biologic agents or supportive care agents such as pegfilgrastim or filgrastim. And they require a much more complicated development and synthesis. And also, it's for that reason, in order to say, okay, these are complicated agents, so now we want you to reproduce all of the original data. Obviously, you'd never get a drug out there because that would be cost prohibitory and patient prohibitory. And it's important for people to understand that issue. But we need biosimilars because we need competition for these drugs when they go off patent. Otherwise, the drugs will continue to be very expensive and not available to patients around the world. What we recognized is that trastuzumab is available only to part of the world because of its expense. It really makes it unattainable for many patients, and or they can only be exposed for a short period of time. So the goal with biosimilars is to provide alternatives. What cost they will have, we don't know, but we know that competition is a good thing. So we started this trial actually now almost 6 years ago, where we went to look at this particular proposed trastuzumab biosimilar. We chose the first line setting in metastatic disease as our area to study and randomized patients to receive trastuzumab and taxane of choice by institution or the proposed trastuzumab biosimilar and taxane of choice. The regulatory guidelines allow us to have a short-term outcome, overall response rate. And if the drug has passed all of these hugely complex prior studies showing structural, physical similarity, similar PK, similar anti-drug antibodies, et cetera, then the overall response rate is taken as proof that this drug is similar. So our overall response rate at 24 weeks was identical between the two arms, essentially. We showed no difference in adverse events or effect on heart function and no difference in immunogenicity. There also was a separate pharmacokinetic study showing exact similarity in healthy adults. So we will continue to follow patients for progression-free and overall survival out to 48 weeks. But the 24-week endpoint is our primary endpoint, and that was the data that we submitted that will be submitted to regulatory agencies. Now, there was also the biosimilar for bevacizumab that was presented as a poster session for lung cancer and also showed equivalency. And there's already an approved biosimilar for filgrastim, but not for targeted agents in cancer. There are approved biosimilar for autoimmune disease out there that people are using based on these kinds of efficacy data.
Do you think that you can just sort of take this data and widely apply it? And for example, would you have any concern about using, let's say, this trastuzumab biosimilar in the adjuvant situation where you're trying to cure somebody?
I feel that based on this data and all of the similar physical and immunologic characteristics, that it would be safe to use this as a substitute for trastuzumab. And I think that in most places where this will be used, the option will be no therapy or trastuzumab. And by the time the patent runs out in the United States, where patients have access to trastuzumab sometimes for decades because they have metastatic disease and have no disease, no progression, that this will come to us after there's a lot more safety data even obtained. And people will feel more confident with the whole idea of biosimilars by that time.
So let's shift over to another area, one that's getting a lot of attention pretty much in every corner of oncology, and that is the use of checkpoint antibodies. And we're now starting to see some data on this approach in breast cancer, and you've been involved with that work. What do we know right now?
It's a good question. I think it matters a lot about the type of disease. So in triple-negative breast cancer, there are two trials. Both were phase 1b expansion trials. Both included 25 to 27 patients, and they gave single agent, either pembrolizumab or atezolizumab. Both showed very similar response rates, 18.5 and 19%, and some of these responses were very durable. I mean, really impressively so. We didn't see a lot of this pseudo-progression. In the pembrolizumab trial, it was suggested that the time to response, the median time to response, was very, very long, but that hasn't been seen in subsequent studies. So we don't know if that was just the vagaries of a small phase 1b expansion trial. There also was data presented by Sylvia Adams, quite nice data at ASCO in the poster discussion session, looking at the combination of nab-paclitaxel and atezolizumab in patients who had heavily pretreated metastatic breast cancer. And they also have seen some very durable responses and saw a high initial response rate. Because it's a single-arm trial, what we know, what we can take home from this is that it's a safe combination, as far as we can tell, and that the responses seem quite reasonable. And the rest of the data is going to come from the phase 3 IMPASSION trial that's ongoing.
What is that looking at?
That's a first-line trial with nab-paclitaxel and either a placebo or a atezolizumab, and only in patients who have triple-negative disease without immediate prior exposure to a taxane and no prior treatment in the metastatic setting. That's an international collaboration.
And just to clarify, the rationale in choosing nab-paclitaxel is because it does not need corticosteroid support?
Right. It doesn't need steroids. And so the idea was that maybe there isn't enough data to say that nab is better in triple-negative disease. You know, there's studies that are positive and studies that are negative. But we're using just the 100 milligram per meter squared dose, which is very tolerable. So it's quite a reasonable choice. And with the idea that you don't need steroids, in our I-SPY neoadjuvant trial, where pembrolizumab is one of the arms, we've actually successfully tapered everybody off of the pre-med of steroids with paclitaxel. Since we couldn't use nab-paclitaxel, there's no indication there in the neoadjuvant setting. So I think you can do a number of different things there. Also, tapering off the steroids seems to be safe to do.
And just to clarify, atezolizumab, which now is approved in bladder cancers, anti-PD-L1 as opposed to anti-PD-1, what's your vision about with the difference between them, and do you think it makes a difference clinically?
We just don't know yet. We just don't have enough information, and we certainly don't have enough information in breast cancer. I think these agents won't all be identical. They are antibodies, so they're all, in essence, biosimilars, and they're different. So these are different drugs. We're going to have to see. I think that understanding in breast cancer whether you need PD-L1 positivity for response is important, and of course, the subsets.
I want to go on and get your take on a couple other new approaches that particularly are being thought about in triple-negative breast cancer. One is anti-androgens and androgen receptor assays. You've done work on this. Where are we today with that question?
We're still learning a lot. I think that now we believe that as clinicians, we can pick out the AR-positive tumors that are at least have a chance of responding a little better. You know, these are indolent cancers. They act more ER-like. They tend to have more bone and soft tissue dominant disease and not, you know, a liver full of tumor. So these patients need to have time to respond and express the androgen receptor. Expressing the androgen receptor alone may not be sufficient, though, because there is data from enzalutamide that suggests that potentially having an immune predictor might be a better way to understand who responds. But that was a retrospective analysis, and now they're doing prospective studies looking to see whether or not they can predict who will benefit, both with the agent alone and in combination with chemotherapy. There are other agents that are being studied. There is, for example, a drug that's an androgen receptor agonist, kind of like a tamoxifen, more like drug. And that will be very interesting to see how that works. That's ongoing treatment in both triple negative and ER positive, AR positive disease.
I don't know if that's the same drug we talked about in a prostate program once. You know, it's like an alternative agent, right? Yeah, interesting. So again, you have the question, anti-androgens are out there, they're accessible, enzalutamide, bicalutamide. Have the data that you've seen up to this point justified the use of this kind of strategy outside a trial setting?
Well, I think, again, I would definitely encourage the enrollment not to open clinical trials because otherwise we're never going to know really how these drugs work above and beyond not treating patients. And I have one triple negative patient who's been NED for 4 years just on her own, you know, after being on the aniparib trial, interestingly. So you just don't know from a phase two trial what it is that's working and what's predicting the efficacy of a drug. So the trials are critical. But if you have a patient who's not eligible for any of the trials, then I think that trying to get drug, either bicalutamide or enzalutamide on compassionate use is a reasonable option if you know that a patient has AR-positive disease and can wait to have a response.
What specific assay would you recommend to assess AR status?
We have no idea. And that's one of the problems, is that we just don't know what the right assay is. I think this sort of looking at the AR predict is quite intriguing, but we don't have any idea what is involved in that protected assay right now. So I think testing the androgen receptor with your laboratory is probably the best we can get to right now since we have no standard approach.
So what, just a regular IHC type test?
Yes, by immunohistochemistry, not by gene expression. And that's what the studies have done, and I think it's the best test we have right now. It's generally available. Certainly our lab at the university does AR testing, and central labs also provide AR testing at very reasonable cost.
So the other new strategy, not too new, but new in terms of trials ongoing, particularly in terms of triple negative, is PARP inhibitors, and particularly patients with BRCA germline mutations. Now we do have a PARP inhibitor approved in ovarian cancer or laparib, so again, we're in this situation where theoretically you could potentially use it in other diseases outside of the label. What do we know right now about PARP inhibitors? You're talking about aniparib, the non-PARP, I guess, PARP inhibitor. But what do we know about PARP inhibitors today in breast cancer, and particularly in BRCA-positive disease?
You know, most of our data really comes from, in terms of the single agent, the olaparib study, that showed that the higher dose worked better and that you would get some response in pretreated patients with BRCA1 and BRCA2 associated advanced malignancy data published in the New England Journal. the development of PARP inhibitors was really hurt a lot by the Inipirib story and by some, I think, hesitation on the part of the companies to move forward. So that's really a shame because it's really unbelievable that we don't have a PARP inhibitor approved in breast cancer yet. There is a lot of work going on in the Olympiad in metastatic disease and the Olympia trial comparing to either treatment of physician choice or placebo with olaparib. And then there are a number of other studies going on with other PARP inhibitors. So veliparib has just completed accrual to a randomized phase 3 neoadjuvant trial called the Brightness trial based on our iSpy data that I presented before, looking at either carboplatin with paclitaxel, veliparib and carboplatin, or paclitaxel alone. So it's a three-arm study looking at a primary endpoint of pathologic complete response. And I think the beauty of that study is that it's not just in BRCA mutants. We will check for BRCA mutations, but it's in all comers with triple negative disease. We also have seen very interesting data from talazoparib, which is a novel PARP inhibitor that traps PARP. And so that works a little bit differently than veliparib and olaparib and niraparib. And that agent is being tested in the phase 3 EMBRACA trial, which is patients who haven't progressed on a prior platinum and randomizes to that agent, talazoparib, versus chemotherapy of physician choice. And actually, I have a patient who's now been on it for ER-positive, BRCA-positive disease with a longer response than she got to hormone therapy in the metastatic setting. And this is a patient who relapsed on adjuvant hormone therapy in bone. So clearly, we can see efficacy. Talazoparib, like olaparib, results in bone marrow suppression. So you're kind of jumping around all the time with dose. But I think they clearly have efficacy in patients with BRCA mutations. I'm hoping we can prove that. And I think probably the best two trials are in the metastatic setting are Olympiad and the EMBRACA trial with talazoparib, and then the adjuvant Olympia trial in high-risk patients. In the patients who have sporadic triple-negative disease, the neoadjuvant Brightness trial is incredibly important for us following the TNT data that suggested that response to platinum over docetaxel as first-line treatment in the metastatic setting was really an indicator that you had a BRCA mutation rather than anything else. And so what we need to understand is who are the patients who benefit. And this neoadjuvant trial, I think, will give us a huge amount of information. And it's cool because there are a lot of international people involved in the management of the trial and in the management of the biospecimens that are being collected.
So I'd like you to take a crack at discussing a study that I've always been intrigued at the design. I was wondering how I was going to figure it out once it got presented, the so-called MINDAC study, which was presented this year at the AACR. Really major phase 3, big study done internationally and mainly in Europe, I think. Can you talk about the design of that study, the results that were just presented, and what do you think it means?
MINDACT is a huge trial and a huge effort, and it's really great that they were able to present their primary data now. I think it's a huge effort to be congratulated on. What they did was they took patients based on their genomic risk, so based on the 70 gene score, whether they were high or low. And then they looked at clinical risk. That's a little bit of one of the crux of the issues, which is they looked at clinical risk using adjuvant online and then adjusting it for HER2. The adjuvant online program is not available right now, so it's hard to go back and look at what they did because it's being updated and it has been in that process for a while. Then they decided they would treat based on whether these tests were concordant or discordant. That really what you need to know is, does your genomic test agree with your clinical assessment or not? So based on this assessment, they said if you're concordant low, you get hormone therapy and a trial. If you're concordant high, you get chemotherapy and a trial. The trials help pay for the study. If you're discordant, you get randomized to use either the clinical or the genomic risk as your treatment. So if you were clinical high, genomic low, you could use the clinical to be randomized. If you were genomic high or clinical low, you could use one or the other. Same thing with the other. And then they were randomized. If they were either clinical high or genomic high, they were randomized to get chemotherapy or not. Now, the trial wasn't powered to understand what the true benefit of chemotherapy was. And there's still a remaining question about that, particularly in the patients who were discordant with clinical high, genomic low. That's really where we wanted to have the answer. And in fact, there were more patients who were clinical high, genomic low, than, for example, the small number of patients that were discordant, genomic high, clinical low. So this was a big group of patients. Nonetheless, there are really two things that we can get out of this. One is that those patients did very well at the median follow-up that we now have, which is in 10 years. We still need to wait. It was a group of patients that included node positive and node negative disease. Because nodes weighed in heavily on assessing clinical risk, a lot of the patients who were discordant had positive nodes. But we now know that genomics do play a role in patients who have positive nodes, and that it matters about their response to chemotherapy and their prognosis. Those patients who were genomic low and clinical high had a good outcome. What you can't then say is that that predicts that they won't have any response to chemotherapy. We know their response to chemotherapy is not high, but there was a difference between the two arms. And if you took out patients who we believe to be clinically high risk, not just on nodes, but by other features not included in Adjuvant Online or HER2, potentially you could find a group of patients who are discordant who benefit from chemotherapy. So I think that what I've learned from this is that the 70 gene score can differentiate out a group of patients with a good prognosis in the first 4 years. It can't yet differentiate out, when you look at discordance alone, whether or not there's no benefit from chemotherapy. So if you have a patient who has high risk by clinical features, on today's clinical features, you may want to consider chemotherapy. Now, a patient has node negative, low risk disease by genomics and is grade 3 but has a low Ki-67. This is a patient who could have been discordant on Adjuvant Online, but who I think we all would believe likely won't benefit much from chemotherapy. So really, it requires a lot of in-depth evaluation of each individual patient. But it has moved us ahead again incrementally in trying to understand what the best treatment is for each patient.
So just taking a step back, certainly the 21 gene recurrence score has been the most common genomic assay that's been ordered in breast cancer, much less in terms of the 70 gene. After you've seen this data, do you see more of a role for the 70 gene assay or not really?
Well, I think that it's always hard to balance because those assays haven't been compared to each other. I think both assays have shown a prognostic impact. We have the data in node negative disease from the 21 gene recurrence score that's, I think, quite compelling. And then I think that the 70 gene score, we're going to have more information on trying to differentiate out ultra low versus, you know, sort of medium low, ultra high versus medium high, and that information in the long run may help us further differentiate out benefit. So at the moment, I think that both tests can be very useful in terms of assessing prognosis. The prediction of chemotherapy benefit in terms of dividing out the different groups for the 21 gene score is somewhat limited just by that intermediate risk group where we're not quite sure what to do, and I use clinical criteria as a way to try and decide about chemotherapy or not in that intermediate risk group. And we look really with great excitement for the data from the Taylor X trial that will give us more information on that intermediate risk group. At the same time, I think that both tests are very, very useful and that we do tend to use the 21 gene score a lot about decisions about chemotherapy for node negative disease. And then we tend to use the 70 gene score a little bit more about decisions in terms of trial participation in the neoadjuvant setting and in differentiating difficult situations where patients have a lot of bulk of disease.
What about node-positive disease? There's been a lot of controversy about that. There's a recent ASCO guideline saying don't use it. What's your take on that?
You know, there's the data from MINDAC that suggests that if you take patients with very high clinical risk, maybe assessed a little bit differently, that maybe there's some benefit in chemotherapy. So maybe the ASCO guidelines was sort of erring on the side of too much caution by saying you shouldn't use it and, you know, that you might not give chemo to somebody who would benefit. On the other hand, patients who have 1 to 3 positive nodes who have a very indolent cancer seem to benefit very little from chemotherapy. So I actually don't agree with those ASCO guidelines. And I think both the 21 gene recurrence score and the 70 gene test can be used to try and understand who has minimal node involvement, who might be able to be spared chemotherapy.
I was talking with George Sledge about this. I mean, he was saying that he's heard or he's experienced people having problems getting reimbursement now in the node positive situation because of this ASCO statement. Is that something you've had happen to you?
We haven't run into it quite yet. I can generally make a pretty good case for using the test But I do know that this is an upcoming and ongoing, potentially increasing issue. And I think it would be a shame because tumor biology is incredibly important. You can't take it out of context of the clinical features, but it is incredibly important. So I think not allowing us to look at tumor biology in these patients would be an unfortunate decision.
So I want to move on and talk a little bit about ER-positive metastatic disease. But I want to start out asking you about a poster you had at ASCO reporting on work you've been doing for a while now, looking at everolimus-associated stomatitis, and specifically the use of a dexamethasone-based mouthwash for that. What is your report there? And in general, what have you seen in your trials and your own clinical practice?
So we had started, myself and Joyce O'Shaughnessy, actually using a steroid compounded formula with hydrocortisone and nystatin some time ago and found anecdotally that we weren't seeing stomatitis anymore. So both of us actually have run trials looking at mouthwashes to try and see if we could reduce the rate compared to the historical control of Bolera 2. Our trial used an over-the-counter alcohol-free dexamethasone solution that's used for pediatric dosing, and patients swished it in their mouth and spit it out four times a day. And we used the 8-week incidence of grade 2 or greater stomatitis as our endpoint because in a previous publication, we've shown that almost all of at least 80% of stomatitis grade 2 or greater occurs by 8 weeks. The study that Joyce O'Shaughnessy has done has actually looked at two different steroid formulations to try and see if there's a better one or not. We don't know those results yet. We reported our data on more than 90 patients using this mouthwash with an 8-week endpoint that showed no grade 3 stomatitis and a marked reduction in grade 2 stomatitis, as well as grade 1, actually. So we went from over 17% to about 2.4% of grade 2 stomatitis, and grade 1 also was reduced. Patients tolerated it very well. Only 2 patients had any fungus in their mouth, and we used nystatin as sort of a chaser in some patients, and that was able to control the fungus very well. Nobody had any serious fungal infections. One of the patients, interestingly, developed grade 3 stomatitis very late, so after our 8-week endpoint, and that patient had had grade 2 stomatitis and was dose reduced but kept having grade 2 stomatitis, and then it eventually sort of turned just barely to grade 3, and she really did meet the criteria for grade 3 stomatitis. So I think that there will clearly, no matter what you do to prevent the toxicity, there will clearly be patients who just are uniquely sensitive. And, you know, it seems to be also a window onto how much drug the patient's actually seeing, because we did a meta-analysis and it seemed like patients did at least as well, if not a little better, who got stomatitis. So they must be seeing, at least in some cases, more drug. But I believe that this should now be our standard of care for patients receiving the mTOR inhibitor everolimus, because we can tremendously improve the rate of stomatitis and therefore quality of life, although we didn't specifically study quality of life.
How often do they take it and for how long?
So we use the mouthwash 10 cc's to swish, hold for 2 minutes and spit 4 times a day. And then at 8 weeks, you could either continue or stop. And almost all patients continued. But what I found in one of my patients who had a nice long response to everolimus is that she's a physician and she would reduce the frequency. You know, she'd just get busy and stop using it. And then she'd get an aphthous ulcer, she'd start it up again. So most patients, at least in my experience, found that it continued to be useful over time if they were going to get mouth sores.
Interesting. What do you find in terms of residual types of side effects and toxicity once you ameliorate the stomatitis, for example, fatigue?
So fatigue is a big issue with everolimus and also with the CDK4/6 inhibitors. And, you know, it's a tough one to manage. I've used methylphenidate in our metastatic patients where I didn't want to reduce the dose or because of their bulk of disease or other issues. Dose reducing, giving a holiday for a few weeks helps if you can do that. And again, I found that methylphenidate can be useful as well for these patients. It's a tough one. You know, I mean, I think we obviously want to rule out other causes such as hypothyroidism and polypharmacy, but fatigue is clearly a side effect we see over time in these patients. For mTOR inhibition, you know, we're still dealing with the issue of interstitial pneumonitis, and that does occur in patients over the course of their treatment, and most of what we see is just radiographic, and we don't have to do anything. But clearly, physician and patient education is critical to catch it at grade 2 and never get to grade 3.
I was going to ask you about pneumonitis because I was surprised. We had a case recently presented of a patient who had, as you said, commonly asymptomatic pneumonitis. Actually, this patient actually had a few symptoms, I think. where it was held. The symptoms, you know, went away. The patient got corticosteroids, and then it was restarted, which kind of surprised me, at a lower dose. Is that the way you approach these patients?
I do, actually. I restarted a lower dose. The only time I wouldn't is if somebody is truly hypoxic and very, very sick with grade 3 pneumonitis or worse. But I do think that if you catch these patients early, and the way to do that, you know, you never see grade 3, and the way to do that is to stop drug for grade 2 pneumonitis, treat as needed with steroids. And if you're going to restart, wait for them to really get better before you restart. That really makes a big difference. I don't do anything if I just see interstitial changes on the scan.
So you mentioned the issue of hair loss, and I wanted to get an update from you on where things are with cooling caps. So maybe you can provide an update on where we are in terms of getting data and also your clinical experience with the various systems out there.
So I've used the DigniCap, which is a self-contained system with two caps, and that, as you know, achieved FDA clearance last year in December, and we've just started up a clinical plan to use it, and so we have a number of patients using the DigniCap. We've also used the Penguin cold caps a lot, which require, again, renting it. They all cost money. They all cost about the same amount of money. And then you need a freezer. So if you don't have a freezer where you're being treated, the patient has to bring in a cooler with dry ice. We happen to have freezers donated by a philanthropic supporter. And so our patients just need to coordinate the use of the freezer. I will say that it involves personnel time. So you need to have funding for personnel who can either coordinate use of the freezer or coordinate use of the machines and the rooms in the infusion center so that you don't have three people trying to use a machine that can have two people at the same time. And they have a post-cooling time, and that's something we've had to manage because with the Penguin caps, you know, you can get up and leave. You can go sit in the waiting room and do your post-cooling. But with the machines that are self-contained, you can't leave as easily because the machine's plugged into the wall. So these companies are working on having smaller machines that are more mobile, and they're pretty small already, but where you might be able to actually take the machine along with you when you're doing your post-cooling because you need to open up an infusion bed.
Use the term post-cooling.
Yeah.
What is that?
So after you get the cap on, you get the scalp cooler for about half an hour before you start the chemo. But then, you know, it takes a while, not the half-life of the drug, but actually just to get the biggest amount of circulating drug cleared. So depending on the drug, it could be an hour and a half, 2 hours, or potentially even longer. We don't know a lot about what's required for post-cooling time. It's all done by anecdote, and we generally don't go shorter than some period of time where you keep the scalp cool in order to allow the amount of drug in the system to go down. I just want to mention one other system that's being tested called the Paxman system. Paxman is actually doing a randomized trial where patients are randomized to using the cap or not. And that trial is currently still accruing, and they don't expect any results until at the earliest next year. So that'll be very interesting as well. But we do have FDA clearance for a device. So we have the DigniCap and we have the Penguin cap now. So a lot of our patients actually do use scalp cooling.
And what do they tell you in terms of discomfort, inconvenience, and the whole experience?
So it's definitely cold. And it takes more time. And it takes some money. So those are the three biggest things. So I had one patient who said, I hate to be cold. I've already decided I want to use the caps. So that's fine. You know, I've certainly had patients who couldn't afford to use them. And actually, one of the people who helped us with the coordination of the DigniCap trial is working with somebody in Texas on developing a philanthropic fund to help offset the cost for women who truly can't afford to use the caps. So that's one thing. And the third thing is time. And so if you don't want to spend the extra time and you don't mind so much losing your hair, then that wouldn't make sense for you. So those are really the three things that I think people find. Mostly people will take some lorazepam, a mild painkiller, but the beginning cold. Because when it's getting cold is when you have the most discomfort. The cap cools down and you sort of feel like an ice freeze, like ice cream, you know, bit on an ice cube or something. That kind of a discomfort. But it gets better, according to patients, quite quickly. The one thing with the Penguin cap is it's colder, and you change it every 30 minutes. So you keep getting colder, you know, each time as the cap warms up and cools down. But, you know, I have to say the patients who've used it are very dedicated to it and in general are very happy with not losing all of their hair, even if you lost, say, 55, 45% of your hair, right? So you know your hair is going to look different for people who don't have a mass of hair. You're going to have more hair sooner because, not because the hair grows any faster, we haven't shown that, but if you already have half, the time it takes to fill in is less time. And I've seen that over and over again.
What globally is the efficacy of these strategies, and do you even attempt to use it when patients getting an anthracycline?
We actually have had a number of patients use it with anthracyclines in our neoadjuvant setting, and they mostly it's been penguin cap because the DignaCap wasn't available, but now it is, so some people are using it. So we'll see how it works. Clearly, it's harder to keep your hair during AC with the cooling caps, but patients still do. So, you know, maybe 40% keep their hair as opposed to closer to 70%. And, you know, keeping their hair is an individual thing. Your hair gets thinner. You lose hair, for sure. Oh, one of the other reasons why, I forgot to mention, why patients sometimes don't want to use it is you're not supposed to wash your hair more than once a week and style it and color it and all that. And some of our patients said, you know, I'd rather wear a wig than look funny. So it's a very individual thing. But a lot of women are very, very sensitive to this. They want to keep their hair. They want it to be there faster. And they want to have some control over something in a situation where they have very little control.
You see this mainly as a tool in the adjuvant and neoadjuvant setting or also with metastatic disease?
We've used it almost always in the neoadjuvant and adjuvant setting, but I have a couple of patients in the metastatic setting who've used it. One of my patients who's been on numerous lines of chemo and has never lost her hair. It was really important to her.